From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's the central existential dilemma of humankind, the reality that we're all going to die. And it's at the heart of the philosopher Stephen Cave's book called Immortality. In it, he explains how this human preoccupation with trying to cheat death has been the impulse that has driven civilization. We've created these stories and structures that help us cope with the reality of mortality. But what would happen, Cave asks, if tomorrow we all discovered there is no life but this one? What then? What would happen to society? How would we treat each other if we didn't have that deadline always looming over us? Stephen Cave is with us today to talk about immortality and to remind us of this admonition: be careful what you wish for. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Death seems like such a waste. Stephen Cave points out this in his book, that to create such a wonderful creature as a human being only to permit him or her to turn to dust just seems like a cruel cosmic joke. I mean, there's got to be a point, right? Well, in fact, Cave points out human beings have made this fear of death pretty useful. The stories that we've created over time to help us cope with death have been the building blocks for the civilizations we've created. He says this drive for immortality is the foundation of human achievement. It's the wellspring of religion, the muse of philosophy, the architect of our cities, and the impulse behind the arts. Today in the program, Stephen Cave is joining us to talk about our quest to live forever. But he also asks the very useful question, what would happen if we did? Stephen Cave is a philosopher with a PhD from Cambridge University, a regular contributor to the Financial Times. His articles have also appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Wired, and others. His book, as I mentioned, is Immortality: The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. He's joining us today from a studio in Berlin, Germany. That's where he lives. And Stephen Cave, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Pleasure to be on the show.
Well, I wanted to... What was the... How did you get started with this question of living forever? What was the thing that you started thinking about that got you going?
Well, I think we all, as children, wonder about death. And I remember quite clearly when I first realized that I was going to die. And it was just after one of my grandfathers had died. And I was lying in bed at night trying to make sense of this, trying to work out what had happened, where he had gone. And while I was thinking about this, then all of a sudden I realized, well, if it can happen to him, maybe it can happen to me too. It was like he'd fallen through a hole in reality, and I realized, well, maybe this hole in reality could just open up beneath my bed while I was sleeping, and I too would disappear, and what would happen to me, what would become of me? And we all go through this. All children are natural philosophers, and we ask the people around us, then, well, okay, so mum, dad, what's death? What happens? Where's granddad gone? Where am I going to go? And they give us answers. And I suppose I wasn't really satisfied with the answers that the people around me were giving. And so the question never let go of me. And so it informed my studies and my research and now the book.
Did it surprise you how useful this quest for immortality was? Did that surprise you that it was very useful for us as human beings?
Yes, that's exactly right. Because at first it seemed like, okay, there are these myths, there are these stories we tell ourselves. And, well, some of them might be true and some of them aren't, and we have to think about that. But only when I started to look into them did I realize how powerful these stories were, how much they shape our lives and drive what we do.
It's interesting, and we'll work through this as we go. But there's the negative part. It's not all good, this impulse, obviously. I mean, it drives us to build, but it also drives us to be cruel and all those other things. And we'll talk about the particulars of that. But the good part, I mean, the creation of art and philosophy and the way we, I mean, that's embedded in us. And I wanted to talk about this thing that you say, that it's rooted in human nature itself. Mm-hmm. Because you say, you know, there are people who are skeptical about that, that that's, you know, it's too metaphysical, as you put it, to be an instinct. Mm-hmm. But you say this is not metaphysical and it's not mystical. Mm-hmm. You say it's natural. Explain.
That's right. Because at first, the quest for immortality, it sounds vague, it sounds abstract, it sounds spiritual, but it's actually rooted in the most natural thing of all, which is the will to survive.
Right.
So all animals struggle to survive. Imagine if one didn't and, you know, was indifferent to the mouse who went out in broad daylight and didn't care about the owls and the foxes, it would be eaten up, its genes would disappear from the gene pool. So every living thing around us comes from generations and generations of creatures who were struggling to survive. And we do this too, of course. But whereas other creatures might struggle to survive from moment to moment, we, with our massive brains, have this sophisticated sense of the future. We don't want to survive just now, but also until this evening and until tomorrow and for the next 10 years and 100 years and so on and so on. And so for us, this will to survive becomes the will to immortality.
Mm. And that's the drive, you say, that sets us apart from other creatures. And you point out that our intellect tells us that we're going to die. But the one thing you say that our minds cannot imagine is this state of non-existence. You say it's literally inconceivable. And not only that, if we do imagine ourselves as not existing, you say that our imaginative faculties can malfunction. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
So death poses a real problem for us because on the one hand, we look around and everything seems to die. And so we've got these big brains, we can work things out, we can generalize and think, well, if everything else dies, the chances are I'm going to too. This seems like a basic fact. But on the other hand, when we try to imagine what that's actually like, then we fail. Because here we are trying to consciously think about what it's like for our consciousness to end. So whatever we imagine, even if it's our own funeral, for example, we imagine ourselves maybe looking down and the funeral procession slowly going by, but there we are still as the observers. So we can't really conjure this idea of complete non-existence. And so death is a paradox for us. On the one hand, it seems like this basic truth. And on the other hand, it seems completely impossible. And all of the stories we tell ourselves about death are therefore, in a way, trying to reconcile this fundamental paradox.
You say that in some ways these stories that we do tell ourselves are just a way of, you've got these two contrary intuitions. And it would be what do you mean when you say it would be impossible to live like this? That it would be what you call this paralyzing struggle between dread and hope? That the stories that we've created to explain all of this helps us to not just curl into a ball and... You know what I mean?
Yeah. The terror of death is potentially paralyzing. And now, I've said that all creatures struggle to survive, but we can ask whether other creatures, you know, whether an oak tree or a bacteria or a jellyfish is aware that this struggle will one day be thwarted, whether it's aware that it's going to die. And the chances are, our best guess is no. It doesn't know it's going to die. So it just struggles and struggles. But here we are struggling, just like all other creatures. And yet, at the same time, it seems clear to us that this struggle will fail. That here we are, fighting like everything else from day to day and building our civilizations in order to help us live longer. But when we think about it, then it seems that all of our hopes and dreams, they're inevitably going to be crushed. And so we humans have to live in the shadow of this personal apocalypse. And this is, of course, potentially devastating. It's amazing that in the face of this, we still get up in the mornings. But we do, and partly we do because at the same time as death seeming inevitable, it seems impossible. And because we have these stories that then help us cope with this paralyzing fear and to make some sense out of it.
You say there's evidence of this from cognitive psychology that... Tell us about the research of psychologist Jesse Baring, this idea that this paradox, that this is natural, because this is really interesting.
Yeah, Jesse did some interesting research talking to children, and he used puppets, to ask children who had not yet been socialized into a particular religion. And so they were, I don't know, about 5 years old. Well, he used children of different ages who hadn't been socialized into a particular religion. And he asked them what they thought about how a mouse who had been killed, who'd been eaten by a cat or something like that, how this mouse then felt. Like, was it hungry? And the children were, no, it's dead, so it's probably not hungry. But is it sad? Yeah, I think it's sad. Well, it's dead, but it's sad. So this suggests, and Jesse Baring's conclusion is that actually we have a natural propensity to see a mind as carrying forward, to see a kind of life force as carrying forward. We can't really imagine a mind being just extinguished. And he argues that children also believe the same about themselves, that they might have some sense that they might physically die, but they don't believe, therefore, that they cease to exist. They believe their mind carries on. And so even though we're aware of death in some sense from quite an early age, like I was talking about earlier when I realized that I would die after my granddad died, nonetheless, we don't believe it's absolute. And this is something Jesse has shown is natural. It's something that is part of the way we think, even before religious views come right. And explain whether this is because of the soul or what have you.
Yeah, so it's not a cultural thing. I mean, even kids who exactly. Didn't have a worldview yet figured that, well, they couldn't conceive of it. I mean, the mouse had gone, of
exactly.
course, his body, but he had a mind somewhere, some kind of existence somewhere.
Exactly so. That's right. It's part of the way we think about minds, that they just continue like this. And this is based, he argued, on the fact that we can't imagine our own non-existence.
You also write about the effect of when you remind people about their mortality. This has a profound effect or some kind of effect on us, and it doesn't seem so good. Exactly. To talk about this, the studies, this was a group of American psychologists who did this.
Right.
I think
Absolutely.
It was in the 1990s to test that effect on people when you said to them, hey, remember, you're going to die. Explain that.
Yes, this was research that was started by three absolutely brilliant, then very young American psychologists. And their work was inspired by an American anthropologist called Ernest Becker, who was picking up on Freud's work to talk about the fear of death and how that motivates what we do. And until these three psychologists came along, quite a lot had been written about this, but it was very difficult to really prove that the fear of death was shaping the way we act. And these psychologists came up with a brilliant way of doing it. And the idea is very simple. You just take two groups of people who are, in relevant respects, very similar, and you remind one group that they're going to die. And the other group, you tell them to think about, you know, going to the dentist or being lonely or something unpleasant but not fatal. Mm. And then you compare how they behave or how they react or how they think. And so you can get some idea of the effect it has on people when you confront them with their mortality. And what these researchers hoped to find is that when you remind people that they're going to die, then they fire up these defense mechanisms. So whatever beliefs we have that help us to deal with the fear of death, we would see those then more evident if you confronted people with death. And that is exactly what they have found. And there have been now over 400 studies, and there are more coming out every week or every month. It's a real boom area in psychology, and because the case is now so clear. And to give an example, one recent study took two groups of agnostics, so people who are fairly undecided in their religious belief, and it asked one group to think about being dead and the other group to think about being lonely. And then the psychologists asked them again about their beliefs. And those who'd been asked to think about death were afterwards twice as likely to report faith in God and Jesus. So at the beginning, they're all equally agnostic, but put the fear of death in them, suddenly they turn to God and Jesus.
So what does this tell us? That we will behave better if we have a bit of, you know, denial in our system, or at least that we consciously put aside the fact?
What it tells us is that in order to cope with the potential terror of death, we need stories or strategies that say, don't worry about it, get on with your life. And these come in different forms.
Right.
And most of the time we go through our lives, but when we are confronted with death. So this might be the death of a friend, or it might be seeing death on television, or something that reminds us of our mortality. It might, in one example, for example, one researcher interviewed people in front of a funeral parlor, and then interviewed other people a few hundred meters down the road, and found their responses when they were in front of the funeral parlor are very different to when they were asked a few hundred yards down the road. So right. Anything that reminds us of death causes us to then fire up these defense mechanisms. Now, whether that's good or bad depends on what those defense mechanisms are. I mean, right. They might be very innocent, but they might also be nationalism, for example, because nationalism tells you that you can live on as part of a greater whole. So often when confronted with mortality or images of other people dying, people become more aggressively nationalistic, for example.
This is the terror management theory.
This is called terror management theory, yeah. Exactly.
And I like, this is one of the psychologists you quote in the book, that if we didn't have these comforting illusions, we would become, and here's the quote, twitching blobs of biological protoplasm completely perfused with anxiety. It would be a mess, I guess, if we didn't have these stories or some way to, again, cope with that reality, I suppose.
Exactly. It'd be difficult to get up in the morning. This idea that everything we're doing will one day be destroyed is potentially paralyzing. And these stories, they help us to deal with that, to get out of bed and get on with life.
We'll talk about the particular stories that we tell ourselves when we get back from a break. Stephen Cave is with us. His book is called Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the certainty of death. The philosopher Stephen Cave says, look, it's natural for us to be preoccupied by death. In fact, it's the impulse that has driven civilization. He says we create these stories to help ourselves manage the reality of death. His intriguing book is called Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. So you were mentioning these stories that we tell ourselves, these four narratives that are present in different forms. And in fact, you say at least one is present pretty much in every culture. Mm-hmm. But I wanted you to talk about ancient Egypt, because I'm not sure if this is entirely unique, but somehow the Egyptians were able to weave all of these narratives together into a single whole. So let's talk about ancient Egypt, and then we can sort of work through some of these. The first one is staying alive. And the Egyptians had a pretty sophisticated system of warding off aging and illness. Talk about the staying alive part and how that fit with the Egyptians and just how it fits in general.
So ancient Egypt is fascinating for anyone interested in immortality stories, because of course it symbolizes them for us. So, you know, the pyramids, so these are the oldest great monuments we have, these fantastic buildings that really are monuments mm-hmm. to our attempt to defy death. But they really just reflect one aspect of the Egyptians' immortality system that dominated their culture and their economy. Even, you know, some huge chunk of their economy went to building the temples and mummification and the medicines and everything that was required to just keep them going somehow, and created this civilization that was enormously successful and enormously stable. I mean, it lasted for 3,000 years, so we've got some way to go before we equal their achievements. But as you say, their immortality beliefs were very sophisticated, and they had all four of these fundamental kind of death-defying stories that we tell ourselves. And usually today, these four stories are like different options in a marketplace of ideas. But the Egyptians managed to weave them all together into this very satisfying narrative. So, to take the first fundamental kind of story we tell ourselves about death, it's that actually, maybe, if we're lucky, we don't have to die at all.
Right, right.
Maybe if we're really lucky, we can stay alive. And as mad as it might seem, actually, all cultures in history have some story of an elixir of life or a fountain of youth, and that goes for ancient Egypt too. So although we think about the mummies and the pyramids, actually Plan A was very much to not die in the first place, to not need to become a mummy. And some of the oldest medical documents that we have come from ancient Egypt, and they show how to mend a broken leg and how to cure a cold and how to cure aging and how to avoid death. So, you know, this is a culture that had a powerful belief in an elixir of life.
So staying alive is the first narrative we tell ourselves. The second, well, before I move away from staying alive, do you see that still? Where do you see it in particular cultures maybe that may exist today, this idea of staying alive?
Well, what's really fascinating about these four immortality stories is the way we see them repeating again and again through history in different cultures. If you like, each generation or culture retells the story, but using the vocabulary of its day. And so we also tell ourselves this story about maybe we don't need to die. But we, of course, use the technology, the language not of magic, but of medicine and technology. So we think, well, maybe genetic engineering or stem cells or nanotech or something is going to cure disease and cure aging for good, and we'll all be able to live forever. And, you know, we might not completely believe it, but we like to read the headlines, you know, aging about to be cured. In America alone, $80 billion is spent on anti-aging products, even though not one of them is proven to work. So we want to believe these stories.
And when we come face to face with the realities, then we move into some of these other narratives. Certainly for the Egyptians, the resurrection narrative was kind of a way, I guess, of hedging their bets, which explains, of course, the mummies. All right, if I am going to die, which they saw people dying all the time, and they realized it's probably going to happen, then the resurrection narrative emerges. Talk about that one.
That's right, because, as you say, we look around and, you know, most people, I mean, even those who take the elixir, the one thing everyone who has taken the elixir in history now has in common is that they're 6 foot under. So we look around and we think, okay, maybe this time stem cells or whatever will sort it out for us, but maybe not. We need a plan B. And plan B is resurrection, because it's the next step. So staying alive means you want to stay alive in this body. It seems the safest option. We know what it's like to live in this body, you know, here and now. Well, resurrection stays with the idea that I am this body, this organism, and says, okay, take death on the chin. I might have to die, but maybe I can rise again and physically in this body live again. And of course, in ancient Egypt, we see this very powerfully in the form of the mummies. So a real desperate and also very sophisticated attempt to keep the body together, to stop the natural process of rot and decay. And a huge amount of time and resources was spent on doing exactly this. And of course, you know, they were quite successful. We still see, you know, museums all around the world are full of people who should have rotted away a long time ago. So this belief is very, it comes very naturally to us once we recognize that death is likely to happen, and was absolutely fundamental to the Egyptian theology.
And of course, it's very particular to a lot of religious worldviews as well, Christianity in particular, but others as well, this idea that Christ would rise again and therefore set the example for the rest of humanity. That's a resurrection narrative.
Yes, and you know, in lots of ancient myths, including in ancient Egypt, there are stories about men or gods or kings or godmen dying and yet somehow being reborn, being resurrected. And by doing so, they free the way for all of us to live again. And this is exactly what Christianity is. So Jesus, of course, he dies and everyone, all his followers despair. But then 3 days later, he rises from the tomb. And by being resurrected himself, by conquering death himself, he's conquered death on behalf of all of us and holds out the possibility that we all might be resurrected. So Christianity is, of course, based on this resurrection story. But what not all believers are aware of is that not only is it based on the resurrection story of Jesus, but Christianity promises a very explicit resurrection for us all. So the resurrection of the flesh is part of fundamental doctrine, the Nicene Creed, the Apostle Creed, you can find it, resurrection of the body. So this is something that is at the heart of of Christian belief and also Jewish belief and also Islamic belief, for example, the mm-hmm. idea that we will physically rise from the tomb.
But let's say, and this is what they did to Christians. You mentioned the early Christians who, the Romans or others who were aware of this belief in resurrection, they would cut them into bits and they would burn their bits and separate their bits as a way of sort of foiling this idea of resurrection, which was a problem for Christians, you write about. And so there was another sort of fallback mechanism, another of these stories, and that is the idea of the soul.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Resurrection has various problems. And one of the oldest problems is the cannibal problem, for example. What happens if you die and you're eaten by cannibals and God wants to resurrect, and then the cannibal dies of overeating, and God wants to resurrect you both? Well, but if some bits of you have become bits of the cannibal, then one of you is going to have a hole in you, or you know, what happens? And so this is difficult. And the whole idea to some people is just, you know, it's just too much like a kind of a zombie film, this idea of, you know, crawling out of the grave.
Yeah.
And so to solve these problems, we can use the idea of the soul, the idea that I'm not just the body. See, the staying alive, it stays with the idea that I'm a body. Resurrection stays with the idea that I'm just this body. Mm-hmm. But then this third story, the soul, it says, well, maybe you're not. We can get away from the messy body and all these problems that it causes. Maybe the real you is a completely non-physical, immaterial thing. And when your body dies, it just floats free. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a view that was quite popular already in ancient Greece. And in early Christianity, a number of converts to Christianity brought this view with them and introduced the idea of the soul, and thereby helped to solve the problems of resurrection. And so after about 1,000 years of Christianity, we ended up with this kind of dual doctrine of, yes, you will be resurrected, but in between, don't worry, you live on as a soul. So you have both. We find now in modern Christianity both stories alongside each other.
The fourth narrative, there's a fifth that we're going to get to, which is really crucial. But the fourth, the story that we tell ourselves, this was a big one for the Egyptians as well, and that's legacy. You say that the Egyptians saw legacy as crucial to their survival. Explain that story.
Yes, like a lot of ancient peoples, they saw the echo they left in the world, their kind of resonance, the footprint they left in the world, if you like, as a fundamental part of themselves. So their name was a part of them. Mm-hmm. If they had a statue made of them, that became a part of them. Or pictures of them carved into the sides of temples. All this was a way of expanding the self, and it was just as real to them as the body. And so if you wanted to live on, then when you died, not only did you have to have your mummy made and your soul had to be cared for in certain ways, but also your ancestors had to chant your name, and they had to look after the little statue of you, or come to the temple where pictures of you were carved into the walls. And this was fundamental to Egyptian civilization. And if someone did something really, really terrible, like the great queen Nefertiti mm-hmm. did, as I talk about in the book,
right.
then the punishment is not only to kill her, not only to destroy her mummy, but also to wipe out her name from history. And we see this again in Greek culture, and we see it in Roman culture, the idea that the worst punishment was to eradicate them completely from history, so it's as if they never existed.
This is a big one.
And I think this shows how important this idea of legacy is to us.
Yeah, I mean, and this isn't something just from ancient Egypt. I mean, this is a narrative that you see in modern civilization too, I expect.
Absolutely. I mean, we have inherited this part of modern civilization from the ancient Greeks, for example, from the story of Achilles, which we still tell. You know, I remember reading it as a kid, and you know, now recently there was the film Troy with Brad Pitt playing Achilles. And you know, it's one of our favorite stories, and mm-hmm. it's a story about how a man, Achilles, sacrificed his life. He went into battle knowing he would die in order to win a legacy, in order to become famous, in order to become immortal through his deeds. Because the Greeks believed that, in a way, this kind of fame was more substantial than biology, then messy biology. We all know organisms die, but this kind of fame can live on. Well, and Achilles was right, of course, because here we are still talking about him. But his quest for fame is, well, as widespread as ever. And if anything, now digital technology and mass media has allowed even more people to dream of fame. A few thousand years ago, you had to be a great warrior or a great king, whereas now anyone with, you know, an internet connection and a funny cat can hope to reach millions of people.
I want to, there's a theme, I think, that's developing in the comments we're getting so far, and so I want to get to this. Here's one that comes from Michael, who writes, I've been reading Ernest Becker's Denial of Death and found it dense and confusing. I suppose we can talk a little bit about, but here's the sort of the kernel of the thought from Michael. He says, I lost my faith in God, and suddenly I had to grapple with the reality and permanence of death. But I found such beauty and solace in the idea of being finite, knowing this is my only life. He says, I take comfort in knowing that I am made of star stuff. This is a quote from Carl Sagan. And that is enough, he says, to be marvelous. No afterlife needed. And that seems like a theme that we're getting from others, this idea that, look, I don't need to know that. I can be fine with this idea of there being a finite existence, that there is nothing after that. I think it's something that Clayton wants to say as well. And Stephen Cave, hold on, let me get this from Clayton, who's joining us from Bountiful. Clayton, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks, Doug, and thanks, Steve. Yeah, I've been an atheist myself for the past 10 years. And I've recently been charged by my brother-in-law as being one of these quivering piles of biologic goo, unable to get up in the morning. But I assure you, there are millions of atheists and a growing number who get up just fine and have found meaning in their lives. The second comment, I thought you kept referring to the stories that people have invented and perpetuated to comfort themselves. I really now just consider these lies. And for me, it's much more reassuring to think of other ways to find meaning in my life instead of feel like I'm being lied to.
Right. Okay. Two good points. Stephen Cave, you get this all the time, I'm sure, and we're going to work into that this last narrative that you write about. But how do you deal with that question of atheists who are saying, or people who don't believe, and they're fine with it? How do you respond to that?
Well, yes, and well, I very much welcome it because it's now the position that I've come to. But it's always a journey to get there. And I mean, when I started researching this topic, and it became clear to me that we told ourselves these stories again and again, these four stories that repeat, it wasn't clear to me that none of them was true. It wasn't clear to me. I didn't initially think, as Clayton said, he now thinks, that they are lies. But rather, I wanted to find out if any of them might be true. It was like having four doors in front of me and believing behind one of them was treasure. And so, you know, I opened the first one and, it's not there. Move on to the next one. Not there. You know, only by the time I got to the end had I started a different thought process where I had learnt a lot about people who had in fact rejected these stories and had come to find another way of finding peace, of coming to terms with death. And it was really looking into that and finding that actually in a lot of cultures, in a lot of different times, people have developed an alternative to these four stories that I found a very, to me, inspiring alternative way of looking at it.
But this question comes up, and you raise this in the book. There's a crucial question in what the psychologist William McDougall wrote, and you include this in your book. He believed that it was highly possible that a decline in the belief of a soul, for example, one of these stories, would be what he called the passing away of this belief, he says, would be calamitous for civilization. And you mention also the Cambridge philosopher C.D. Broad, who didn't believe in an afterlife, by the way, but said it's quite possible the doctrine of human immortality, whether it's in fact true or false, is one of those socially valuable myths. So the idea of it, whether or not there is an afterlife, it seems like what they're saying is It doesn't really matter. The fact is, it's been valuable for us. Look at our cities. This impulse has been good for us. It's a valuable thing for us to have this kind of cognitive dissonance, I guess.
Well, I certainly think it's a legitimate worry, or at least a question to ask. You know, how would civilization be different if we didn't have these beliefs? But I think there is also a positive answer.
Right.
And I mean, the quotes that you mentioned, you know, it's long been a worry, particularly amongst the elites, who think, well, okay, we kind of know it's not true, but we need the simple folk here to believe in this, because
right.
this is how we get them to do right. what we want them to do.
And opium of the masses, right?
The masses, exactly. Yeah. It's the great lever you have to get the masses to do what you want to do. You say, well, if you assume everyone is afraid of death, then you come to them and you say, I can solve all of your problems. I've got this fantastic plan. We're all going to live forever. You just have to do what I say. You know, and so certain religions all religions really have been abused in this way. People have been saying, well, no, if you want to get a place in heaven, you have to, well, right now in Iraq, go and fight for the Islamic State. You have to go and blow yourself up, for example. You know, this is a perfect example of how these stories are abused by elites to get others to do what they want to do. So throwing them off will indeed change civilization, but it could also be liberating.
Right. You believe there's, in fact, as you say, no need for despair. In fact, there's another narrative, a fifth narrative, a wisdom narrative. And we're going to talk about that when we get back from a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the philosopher Stephen Cave. We're talking about his book, Immortality: The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. So you present in your book then this fifth narrative, this other story, one that tries to deal with the mortality paradox, but doesn't promise, you know, to deliver eternal life. But it's not a new concept. We should say that right off the bat. It's this wisdom narrative, and you find it in a couple of places. The Gilgamesh story is one. Tell us about the wisdom story, the wisdom literature, and how the Gilgamesh story sort of provides us a way to kind of accept and live with mortality.
So I call this alternative story, this alternative way of thinking about death, the wisdom story, which might sound a bit corny, but it comes from the wisdom literature, as it is called, of the ancient Near East. And this includes some of the books of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. and it also includes literature like the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is this ancient epic, the most ancient, the oldest great story that we have, and a story that was enormously influential for many, many thousands of years. It was the story that was used to teach people writing. Scribes would copy it out in different languages. So it was a very influential story that really associates the idea of wisdom mm-hmm. with accepting mortality,
right.
with overcoming not only the fear of death, but also the temptations of these immortality stories. And it's a fantastic read. I can recommend it to anyone. And it's about this king, Gilgamesh, who, he's an arrogant young man, and he makes this great friend, and they go off on all sorts of adventures, killing ogres and the likes, and until they go too far and they offend the gods, and so the gods kill Gilgamesh's friend. And at first he's grieving, much like I was for my granddad in the story I told at the beginning. And then suddenly he realizes, well, hang on, if it can happen to my amazingly strong, powerful friend, can it happen to me? So it's about this moment of realization that I described I had when my grandfather died, this moment of realization we all have, that if other people die, maybe we can too. And then Gilgamesh leaves his kingdom, goes off into the wilderness in search of immortality. And he does various things in order to try to become immortal, and eventually realizes he can't. And he meets this wise woman who's a barmaid, who may or may not be a goddess. You know, we've all been there. And she says, look, Gilgamesh, stop this. Pull yourself together. Realize that immortality is not for us. That's for the gods alone. We are mortals, and go back, look after your city, look after your wife, love your children. That is a good life. Enjoy each day. And that's the simple message of this of this wisdom literature. And it's amazingly similar to what we find, for example, in Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
It says something very similar. And so this is a powerful subcurrent, a powerful theme, always combating or providing an alternative to the immortality stories.
Ecclesiastes, you mention, here's one reference. For the fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. But then to this question, what are we supposed to do with that? And then here's another reference that you mention in the book from Ecclesiastes. It says, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. Which is so interesting, this idea that, look, just get over it. You know, go have a drink, enjoy your life. It's a reality. And I think people might be surprised that you find that in, you know, in the Bible of all places.
Yeah. Yeah, the Bible contains a number of different approaches to death. And this one, Ecclesiastes, as I say, is very typical of the kind of wisdom literature of the Near East at the time. But I think there's a way in which that literature isn't enough. I mean, these are, you know, Gilgamesh is a great story, and I think it can help. It's worth reading. But it isn't enough, because we were talking earlier about the mortality paradox and our inability to imagine not existing. And so even though someone might say, look, death's the end, dust to dust, so enjoy yourself now, there's going to be this lingering doubt, but hang on, but is it the end? And so we see in the ancient world this belief that we actually go to some kind of dusty underworld, some grey half-life, because we can't imagine really ceasing. And it took Greek philosophy and the figure of Epicurus to say, no, that is wrong. I know we can't imagine ceasing to exist, but that's a fact. And exactly because we completely cease to exist, that is why it is irrational to be afraid of death. It is natural to be afraid of death, but it is irrational. And famously he said, death is nothing to us because when we are here, death is not. And when death is here, we are not. We've gone.
Hmm.
And it seems like he's the first person in history, at least recorded history, to really get this, to really understand that it means the cessation of experience, and that that's why we don't need to be afraid. That when, if we were immortal, if there was something after death, we might think, well, it might be a terrible thing. Hmm. Should I be scared of that? You know. But exactly because it is the end, we don't need to. And this is very difficult to grasp. I mean, we talked earlier about how this creates a great deal of dissonance for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to use metaphors to help us to grasp it. More recently, the Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein said, we don't need to be afraid of death because death is not an event in life.
Mm-hmm.
We do not live to experience death. It's like a kind of horizon which we can't look beyond.
It's interesting, too. One of the things you raise these questions, which I hadn't really thought about, you know, let's say there was such a thing as immortality. You know, what would we do with ourselves? You know, what would the psychological effects of immortality be? I mean, Borges, for example, his observation that given infinite time, all men would become great, but all pathetic. That, you know, that this internal life, the eternal life would just be kind of a joke. And I guess it's that sort of idea of be careful what you wish for, I suppose.
Exactly. I think this is the other strand to the wisdom narrative and coming to terms with death. One is, the first one we just talked about is realizing that death is not so bad as we think. The second one is realizing that not dying, that actually living forever would probably be much worse than we think. And numerous writers in history have expressed this wonderfully, and Borges is certainly one. In this little story, The Immortal, he talks about a Roman centurion seeking the river that will cleanse us of death. And then in this search, he comes across these troglodytes, he calls them, these men who are living in pits. One of them has been lying down for so long that a bird has nested on his chest. And he starts talking to them, and he realizes these are the immortals, and they don't feel blessed, they feel cursed. And turns out one of them is Homer, who wrote the Iliad, the story of Achilles that we were talking about earlier.
Mm.
And the guy says, well, that's amazing. I mean, aren't you incredibly proud? And this immortal says, no, no. If you're immortal, it's inevitable that you will write the Iliad and the Odyssey at least once. So, you know, we all end up doing everything.
Yeah.
And we all cease then to become individuals. We all, and ultimately, of course, it becomes boring, it becomes meaningless, and you end up living in a pit with a bird nesting on your chest.
Right. Because you also point out that the constraint of finite time shapes us. Death is the source of all of our deadlines, you say. So what happens if that deadline disappears? I mean, would we lose a sense of living life, the vibrancy of life? Because you also point out the value of a thing is related to its scarcity. So what happens if our days were not numbered? Would we really value them as much as we do now?
I think that's exactly right, because there's good evidence that life is already, for most people, in the industrialized world anyway, so long that we don't appreciate it enough, that we forget to value it. And well, I say in the industrialized world, but I think this is what the Old Testament was talking about in Psalm 90, where it says wisdom is learning to number your days. Learn to number your days that you may get a heart of wisdom. Remember that your days are numbered, because when you remember that, you will value them. And so psychiatrists, for example, who work with the terminally ill, find that after these people who receive a diagnosis of cancer, for example, after they get through a period of denial, can attain a state of elation, where they feel a renewed sense of the value of life and of purpose, and they renew their relationships and they feel this deep sense of love and connection. In other words, they realize their time is very, very limited, and that makes them appreciate what they've got now. And so the risk of telling ourselves these immortality stories is they're saying, don't worry about the whole death thing. We've got that covered. You know, if you believe in science, there are people in white coats. They've got the whole death thing sorted, or God or whatever it might be. So you don't have to think about that. But if you don't think about that, you're missing out on something. You're missing out on that which is saying, no, every day really matters. And you really have to live it to the full.
This comes from Kathleen, who writes, as a contented, even joyous, lifelong atheist, also having dealt with breast cancer and faced death up close and personal, she says, facing this last part of my life, I have no problem accepting the finality of life. I get to experience and truly appreciate the awesomeness of this thing we call life, and that I get to be a part of the cycle of life that evolved on Earth and indeed of the universe itself. She says, my acceptance of the finality of life has been a part of my maturity and my wisdom, which sort of echoes something you write in the book, Stephen Cave, this idea that a meaningful life and a productive society require limitations, you say, that define them, that we need this finitude.
Yes, it helps us to get out of bed in the morning. It helps us to value what we do and to give meaning to what we do. We mentioned earlier that, if you live forever, it would be inevitable you write the Iliad and the Odyssey and did everything else, you know, became a bouncer in a stripper bar or president of Belgium. And ultimately, meaning breaks down because we've all done everything. Everything is possible. But if you have to choose how to live your life because your life is finite, then suddenly that choice matters. Whether you decide just to make money or instead to go and help the poor, well, that's an existential decision. And so the finitude helps give structure and meaning. It makes our life into a story. Mm. No one would just read a story that just rambles on forever. That's not a story. A story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's what gives it shape and meaning. And the same is true of our lives.
Mm. So the idea is to wed, as Alan Siegel puts it, this historian who said, wisdom and mortality are wed. The idea is to get them together, those ideas. And I wanted to ask finally, you mentioned three particular themes that come from wisdom literature, these virtues that I think are important. One of them, identifying with others. Another, gratitude. Will you talk about the importance of some of these things finally?
Yeah, so I think what people who have followed this wisdom tradition have realized is that it isn't easy. It doesn't come naturally. The fear of death can be very powerful. And the sense that actually somehow we live on is also very powerful. We've talked about both of those. These are powerful psychological instincts. And overcoming them isn't just a one-off decision, but it's a kind of practice. It's a way of life. And there are certain virtues. There are three virtues, I think, that we can adopt that help us to live according to this wisdom narrative. And these three virtues, they're virtues anyway. They'll anyway be good for you.
Right.
But I think one of their effects is that they help us to cope with the fact of mortality. And these three virtues are gratitude, and living more in the present, and selflessness. And if you think that fear of death is really, it's projecting into the future, the idea that you are going to die. Well, so don't think about the future so much. Think about the present. Because in the present, you are not dead. This is something Wittgenstein, I mentioned the Wittgenstein quote, you know, that we don't live to experience death. For as long as you are here in the present, you're not dead. Stop worrying about what might happen if that is hindering you from appreciating now and appreciate the present moment. And secondly, selflessness. Of course, death is worrying that you yourself are going to die. And if you spent your whole life focusing on yourself as the big project, self-actualizing, self-fulfilling, etc., then the death of the self seems like the end of all your projects. Mm. But if instead you focused on other people, on helping others or a certain cause, for example, trying to become part of the flow of life, as your listener mentioned, then your own death seems much less important. And thirdly, the third virtue is gratitude. And this is really trying to stop worrying about what we might lose. I mean, death is worrying about what we might lose. We might lose life. And instead trying to cultivate a sense of appreciation for what we have. I mean, if you think about how unlikely it is that you or I exist, how unlike the story of evolution, the billions of ancestors we've had, how each one of them had to come together, how, you know, up to your parents, who'll have their own peculiar story of how they found each other. It's each one of us. It's so unlikely that our lives came to be that we can only be profoundly grateful. So instead of worrying that it should end, we should be grateful for each moment that we have.
Stephen Cave, writer and philosopher, his book, Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, joined us from a studio in Berlin. Stephen Cave, thanks very much.
Thank you. Pleasure being on the show.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Michael Shea is our intern. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.